Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora, it's caucus time again, so let's call this meeting to order because it's just a month to election day, guys.
Woohoo!
I'm Tim Watkin.
I'm Julian Wilcox.
I'm Lisa Owen.
And I'm Guyan Espiner.
And what we want to talk about today is the trend, why it's looking the way it is, and really importantly, the shape of the next government. What the trend is telling us the a government might look like, a bit of a deep dive into Action New Zealand First, how it connects with National, and maybe a bit of prefu and indigeneity in there as well. So two polls.
Is that a word?
Indigeneity.
Ah.
It sure is.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm owning that. Two polls. National's on 39 or 40%, which gives you this kind of vibe. Yeah. Which is kind of good. But it's evolutionary, not revolutionary, right? It's, you're happy with that. Labour on 27 or 28%, maybe this kind of vibe.
Pull up, pull up. Oh, I thought, I thought it was a warning that you were going to crash into something rather large.
No, that was the phone off the hook. But it sounds like an American phone. Yeah, the people aren't quite listening to them at the moment. But then the main difference between the two polls is this.
And this is not our first rodeo.
So, yeah, the difference between the two polls was Winston, Peters and New Zealand First, because TVNZ, they had Winston, Peters and New Zealand First getting back into Parliament. News Hub had them missing out and not making it. What do we think, guys? What is the state of the trend?
Well, the one thing I would say is that in the News Hub poll, he's only a whisker away from getting in. Yep. Winston Peters and New Zealand First on 4.6%.
Yeah,
right?
Need to be versus, a whisker away though.
Yeah, versus the 5%. If that's where you think it stops.
Yep.
But it's all about the trend. And that's what we look at with all the parties and having two polls in close succession, albeit from different polling companies, they reflect a trend.
Mm. Yeah, look, you're absolutely right on New Zealand First. As much as it pains me to see this, given what Winston is doing and the politicisation of things, Māori in particular, which kills me, the strategy is working. And whether he's there or not on TVNZ or News Hub, 5% on one and 4% whatever it is on the other, yeah, it looks like he's coming back. And that's going to make it interesting. I don't know. We'll talk about that. The other thing I think is, and I think these numbers are baked in, it feels to me like this is pretty much, we're going to be close to this towards the end of the election. It feels very much like how it was in 2008 to me. I think the technician's sound alert was actually apt. It feels like people have just stopped picking up the phone on Labour.
Yeah, why is that, Guyan? Because, and look, I've got to say, people often don't like us saying, hey, we haven't voted yet, don't tell us how we're going to vote. This hasn't been decided. What makes it feel baked in? Why are people hung up on Labour?
I think that once you start seeing a party having a very outside chance only of making it, it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy and people start to write them off. And I think that Labour is in that death spiral now. Yeah. Once you get a two in front of it, you really are struggling to make it work. And then you have to add on all the different complicating parties. I'd probably need four of them to get over the line now.
And so much harder if you're a second term, government looking for a third term, if you're a follow-up Prime Minister like Hipkins is,
There's all that. They really have had, from pandemics to economic crises, they really have had it all thrown at them and a change of leader, and they are looking like they're running out of time.
Yeah.
The other thing is that people look at these figures and some people get the frighteners on, right? So where some people might have been happy to vote for what was considered a minor party or split their vote, they might look at these things and not like the lay of the land and the potential that these figures indicate. And by that I mean, if you have a slight variation in the National Act vote, conceivably, if Winston Peters gets over 5%, he may be needed,
yep.
Which is why strategically Christopher Luxon is not calling TOD on that just yet.
Yes.
So the thing about that is some people might see Winston Peters 5% in this poll, 4.6 in that. They might decide to vote differently to ensure the type of government that they want. At the same time, others might think he's really close to the line now. My vote won't be wasted if I go that way.
Yeah. So it gives you that confidence to say, oh, well, I'm going to indulge in a Winston.
So it could go either way, but I anticipate the variation to be in the National Act New Zealand First is the combination that I'll be looking at with most interest, as some of the news organisations go to weekly polling as we roll into these last few weeks of the campaign. And I think that's going to be interesting. And to pick up on Guyon's point about the death spiral in Labour, I want someone to tell me where these votes are going, because when you look at it, say, let's look at the News Hub one, for example, down 5.5 points. That's a big wodge, right? Down to 26.8%. You look at maybe their friends in a coalition, the Greens, they're only up 2.7. Mm-hmm. So those people are not just going to the Greens. Where are they going?
This is the other reason why we look
across to National and to New Zealand First. Mm. Yeah. There's a lot of people who have swapped their votes between Labour and National over the years. Tens of thousands of New Zealanders do that every
it's
election.
The soft middle,
why so many commentators are going, oh, this is really bad for Labour, because you're not just seeing things moving around within the left and right block. You are seeing movement from voters across that great divide. Right?
Yeah. Which goes to your point about being baked in.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing I'd say is we started our Māori electorate debate. And they're mainly between Labour and the Māori Party, right? The Labour messaging has changed. It's gone to turnout. They've started focusing on get out and vote, as opposed to things like $2 billion fiscal holes, which traditionally wouldn't play to a Māori audience. Yes, they talk about finance administration and the like, but the fact they're now focused on just getting the base out to vote is a worrying sign, and it's something that changed quickly in the last week and a half.
And the problem that Labour's looking at is interesting. And the problem that Labour's looking at with this is that they've got this, what you're talking about, the baggage of the last few years. My history point this week is Winston Churchill, right? In that 1945 election, thank you very much for winning the war, Mr. Churchill. Now go away, landslide loss, literally weeks after the VE Day. The public's just, often after a big traumatic public event, the voters just go, I want a new face. I don't want to be reminded of all this.
Well, that's right, because a lot of people, even listening to this, and I know that you're especially attuned political audience, would consider this a three-term Labour government. I mean, if it is a two-term Labour government, it's the first two-term government since 1984. Mm. I mean, that Labour government was 84 to 90.
And that was the one which blew everything up, right?
Ever since, we've had three-term governments. Now, that's a long time. So this is quite rare. But I don't think I can't even recall anyone making that point, which is an obvious point that anyone with a Google search engine can tell you. But I think that plays to my point that it feels like three terms.
Well, it's the time vortex of COVID and dealing with the pandemic and all those other, what I would consider, national tragedies and crises during that time.
Yeah.
They just distort your perception of time. And I think that is reflected in the mood of people who just want some sunshine. And I use that as a kind of metaphor. They just want some sunshine. But then I think the other thing is that promises don't always happen immediately. So it's going to be really interesting to see whether whoever is in government delivers quickly enough to satisfy voters' need for some light.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good point, Lisa, and I think that Luxon is relying on that. I think this idea that National drifting up to the late 30s, early 40s is probably their election strategy. And I wonder whether ACT is overestimating the extent of change that people want. You know, do they seem to think that New Zealanders are embracing some sort of neoliberal revolution times three or whatever it is, whereas I think your point is probably more accurate, that they want a change, but how much change do they actually want?
Yeah. It doesn't feel like a landslide election, does it? It feels like we've just had enough of this for now. Can we change our shoes and put on a different pair of sneakers? You know,
the beach, the blue. They talk about the beach cricket analogy in politics sometimes, where it's someone else's turn to bat.
That's right. And I think the other thing is it feels like Hipkins is wedged, because he can't really go too much more negative on Luxon, because Luxon looks like the guy. Now, say, for a couple of interviews, and I know we'll talk about that. But in the general population, I mean, look at the preferred prime minister poll.
Yeah.
Now, you know, he's even, in fact, in one, he's 1 point ahead of Hipkins.
Well, these two, they're torn. They're drawn in both, tied up in both, which is really interesting.
Tied in unpopular territory, which is the interesting thing here. And being the nerds that we are, we were talking about it just before, that looking back, I was thinking, when was the last most unpopular preferred prime minister who actually got elected, right? And what were their ratings like? Because when you look at these two, they're on, what are they, 23%, I think?
23 and 22.5.
23%. And you think of the halcyon days of John Key, who was, up in
40s.
The high 40s, yeah. Not just 40s. Mm. And even Helen Clark, in the year that she lost, was in the mid-40s, right? So potentially, this country is
about
to elect.
Where did Helen Clark start, though?
19%.
There you go. Yeah. That was the last least popular
and
prime minister.
And this 2% because she was at 2% in opposition.
That's
right.
So she was, in recent history, the least popular polling preferred prime minister to be elected. And what we're seeing again is that regardless of who takes the reins, the person who will be in the Prime Minister's seat has got very low ratings.
But the thing that I see in these polls is that Luxon, there are clearly, as you say, it's low, the numbers are low around him, but he seems to have passed some kind of sniff test, right? He's the mover in these preferred Prime Minister things. He's up a few percent. And even though he's still neck and neck with Hipkins, there seems to be, the way the party vote's going as well, we're not going to love him, but we're going to, that was why we put the thing at the beginning, right? They're not going to love him. They're not going to embrace him.
When we started,
but he's all right.
We talked about Hipkins' plan probably should try and turn this into a presidential kind of approach of a campaign because of the lack of trust in the way in which the audience was receiving and the voters were receiving Luxon at the time. At 23% each or 1% down on the other one, he can't do that.
That moment's gone.
So what do you do if you're Hipkins, right?
Yeah.
You can only really focus on a $2 billion a hole in your tax policy, which is what they're doing at the moment. But he can't go too much more negative because, as Lisa says, and I agree with her, people want sunshine.
But it's interesting. Look, Guy, I know you wanted to play this clip because fascinating interview with Luxon on Q&A this weekend.
That's one way of describing it.
Yes. He still sometimes does get exposed, right? Let's have a listen to this.
Are you going to lower your rents, the properties that you rent out?
It's not about me, Jack.
You've said that your settings are going to lead to lower rents.
You talk about my properties every time.
No, it's a simple question. Yeah, I know. Well,
it's pretty simple.
Reasonable, isn't it? I mean, you've got multiple investment properties.
Well,
so will you be lowering your rents?
What I'll be saying to you is that we are going to put downward pressure on rents by actually unwinding the Brightline test from 10 to 2 years and unwinding interest deductibility and changing some of the tenancy laws.
Okay, so will you be lowering your rents?
That is advice that the government put in place to this government. Treasury put into
Again, you're not answering my question. So you say there's going to be downward pressure on rents. So will you be lowering your rents?
It's not about me, Jack. I don't know. I haven't thought that through, and I'm not thinking that through.
A couple of things I would say about that. It surprised me that he hadn't done the homework on that, or some of his advisors hadn't. What's an obvious question that you're going to be asked? Well, what would you do with your own properties? So he should have had an answer to that. The other point I'd make is I actually thought, and this might be an outlying position, that Luxon did relatively well in that interview. I just think it was an extremely good and sharp interview, possibly one of the better ones I've seen on television as a political interview in recent years, and very forensic. I thought Luxon struggled, including in that area, but that he got a bit angry too, which I actually thought was quite interesting. I thought it actually played relatively well for him. I'd like to see a bit more of that with him, where he actually, you know, just lets the management
speak. Well, he
changed
colour a few times. You could see it sort of going from his neck upwards as the conversation was perhaps getting a bit more heated. When you say, you know, it was a forensic questioning of him, if you are selling that you are the competent managers of the economy, then you have to be forensic in the numbers that you present back, right? So there were some really obvious gaps in that interview. The one you point out about when he was asked about his own rental properties. And then obviously the numbers that they have worked out their foreign buyers tax on.
Yeah, which are still in trouble. Yeah.
But when you go into a long form interview and you know that you're going to be speaking to someone for 15 minutes, you can't just roll out those little sound bites. And
but he did. Did you hear him try and
yes.
there? It's simple.
You
it's pretty simple.
Us.
It's not about me, Jack. It's not about me. He goes back, and this is where he comes across as the first term MP that he is, that he just has his
he
lines.
He speaks an advertising
just
slogan.
Goes to, and it drives me nuts.
This takes me back to the preferred Prime Minister stakes, and it comes down to a couple of things, I think. Ideally, voters would like someone who is competent, but they do like charisma too.
Yeah.
So they'd like you to have competence and charisma. That would be the best case scenario. And then they'd like you to at least have one of those things. So, you know, when you look at what you've got here, those are the things that you can leverage, which brings back to what Julian is saying about Chris Hipkins is trying to pull the competence lever and saying they've got holes in their numbers. I am a competent manager of the numbers. Neither of them come across particularly charismatic. So I think in that case, it's a Helen Clark scenario. You have to be razor sharp in terms of knowing your own policy, knowing the figures, knowing the information.
It's also one of the downsides of success, right? Because who's talking about Labor's GST off fruit and veggies policy, which also we couldn't find one economist in around the Motu who actually thought it was a good idea, similar to the revenue from foreign buyers tax. You can't find an economist who thinks it's a good idea. There's all the focus is on National because this is likely to go ahead, whereas Labor's GST off fruit and veg really is likely to hit the, is likely to be a press release that never happens, right?
Yeah.
Thrown out with the fruit and veg, yesterday's fruit and veg.
Exactly, yeah. It comes up a lot in our Māori electric debates, actually, which is kind of interesting. The other thing about the communication style that Luxon has, though, to be honest with you, I wasn't surprised by the way in which he responded in the interview, because that's his go-to. He leans on these phrases that he's had and continues to roll out when he gets cornered or when he gets pushed. So thanks for the advice, Guy, and for him to get a little angry, because that plays okay with people, because I'm interviewing him on Monday for the week, so I look forward
to
that.
Yeah, wind him up.
But I think people have kind of, maybe people have just got used to him doing that, because you would think ordinarily, as Lisa says, if you've got competence with a bit of charisma, that's great. If you lack a bit of competence, and he should be used to this by now, and he still makes the same mistakes, and yet it doesn't seem to have impacted.
No, but this is the sniff test, right? He's passed the sniff test despite that. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, and it's, I have to be honest and say it's been really hard to get excited about the election campaign, because, you know, if you played some audio
from our company every week.
Well, yeah, that's just got it over the line for me. But if you listen to a lot of the sound bites, as we call them in the media, if I close my eyes, I think any of other elections and campaigns, I could have heard those words coming out of either party's mouth, right?
Oh, okay.
So nothing for me has been kind of like, whoa, hey, look at that.
No, well,
that's amazing, right?
Finish your point, but I want to pick up on that.
And I just think the one thing I am terribly excited about, and I'm not being sarky, is the live leaders' debates. And I think that that's going to be telling.
Yeah. Do you think they could still move the dial, though? Maybe.
I just...
Debates can move things.
Either way, I'm interested to see people handling themselves live in a pressured situation. It's a different scenario, as Guyon would appreciate, with a live audience there, and you're getting these questions coming at you. Your opponent is right there. You're eyeball to eyeball, and you really have to bring it.
Yeah, I think Labor will be counting on the leaders' debate.
It's just about all they've got left now.
Yeah, they're
very frightening, and that's just for the presenter. with more than a million people watching, it was very fascinating to me to see Luxon do the classic. And you see this before All Blacks tests or big netball games or whatever, don't you? Everyone's scrambling to be the underdog. What would he say that Hipkins was the best debater in New Zealand, and he couldn't even beat his wife, sort of thing, in a debate. So it was quite interesting to see him sort of lowering expectations.
I just wanted to pick up the, if we can move on to bring ACT into the discussion, because you talked about the sense that there's this familiarity, right, with the policies. It really has struck me this week that with National in particular, they want a party like it's 2009, right? There is nothing about the key years that they do not want to bring back, and they don't want to, you know, and it's three strikes, it's charter schools, it's public sector targets. It is the same stuff. It is just going back in time.
Well, that's brand consistency.
It's very much so. Very much so.
And Labor's the same. This is what it's a Labor versus capital argument, basically.
But it's the same yo-yo. It's this yo-yo policy thing. Often you get those, and you get certain elections where you get a new suite of policies, new ideas kind of filter through. This doesn't seem like that election, right? It seems like the same, you know, boot camps. We've heard it all before.
Yeah, there's a lack of aspiration. What you want to hear is something about what is our country going to look like fundamentally? How different is it going to be in 2040, 200 years after the signing of the treaty? What is it going to look like? I've heard one leader talk about a lot, Ngāti Waititi, Māori Party. But what you want to hear is a lot more aspiration out of really positive political policy approaches to rebuilding foundations and stuff, because I think what's happened in the last term, people are trying to pull back. Yeah. You know, you've got phrases like let's take our country back and the like, and that's why I don't think you hear as much aspiration, and that's why probably there's a feeling on the ground of people feeling like, oh, this is
And it's about the cost of living today. It's not about the future, right?
But that's a light bulb moment for me. That is absolutely it. You've just nailed. Nobody has come out and said, what I see is this. I see you're able to walk to the dairy at 11 o'clock at night and not be worried about who's walking behind you. Nobody has painted that picture. It's fragmented. There's a lot of negativity because a lot of the policies are aimed at fixing things that are wrong with us. Mm-hmm. So you can't get away from that sort of negative feel to it. But nobody has painted, I think you're right, Julian, the bigger picture of what they would like this country to look like. Little bits of it. Yeah, little bits. Compartmentalised, yeah. But not like the big...
That's seen as a luxury in a cost of living crisis when you can't put food on the table. And I think that does crowd out other things. I'm not saying it should be.
You're still going to give people hope and something to look forward to. And I mean, that's obviously what Grant Robertson was trying to sell all this week with the books. And I know you want to talk about the books at some point. When he said light at the end of the tunnel ain't shining bright enough.
Well, remember the wellbeing budgets? Yeah. I mean, many people have forgotten them, but there was supposed to be a whole dramatic new way of accounting for and allocating resources.
It just feels like aspiration is destabilisation. That's what it feels like. If you go there,
people just need to get through the day.
That's exactly right.
But I tell you what, act on, because I want to come into act now, and because I'm sure David Seymour will say he's the one who's talking about, if not aspiration, real change, right? He's the one who's trying to push that boat through. And look, there was an interview again. We're pillaging Q&A this week, but there was an interview that he gave to Jack Tame July last year, which is quite prescient in terms of the issues now. So let's just play this clip.
National's modus operandi is to huff and puff and threaten to blow Labor's house down, but having campaigned from the right, they traditionally govern from the left. The ACT Party says that's just not good enough. If we believe that Labor and the Greens and New Zealand First's policies were wrong, we've got to have the courage to reverse them. And that's why I'm saying in the first 100 days, that's the litmus test. Are you prepared to take some of this stuff on? Get rid of Three Waters. Get rid of a Māori Health Authority. You should be prepared, for example, to say that we are not going to have fair pay agreements. They'll be dead before their feet hit the ground.
This is a guy who wants to go in full bore, whereas Chris Luxon is trying to paint a different picture and paint himself as more of a centrist.
Will you govern from the centre?
I consider myself very much a centrist, you know, and I'm very much a pragmatist. I came to solve problems because I am sick and tired of us talking about stuff and not getting things done.
But what David Seymour there is saying, first 100 days, we're going to go in hot. This is not just going to be a small change government that we were talking about before. We're saying people only want a little bit of change here. He's saying, heck no. We want a first 100 days, we want a blitz, right?
Yeah. So that was, as you said, what, July last year?
Yeah.
So more than a year ago. And then I think there was a big turning point at the beginning of this week, which is what Guyon is referencing, where he did an interview with Jane Patterson and he floated this idea that he wouldn't go into a formal coalition with the National Party and they would make National come cap in hand for every bit of expenditure and every policy for them to sign off and get over the line, right?
Yeah.
I think subsequent to that, he's probably got the frighteners on because it's a concept that people are utterly unfamiliar with. I mean, it even probably had us journalists scrambling to go, what would this actually work? What does it look like? What's happening? Is it constitutionally possible? You know, so And people were like, oh, that sounds like unstable government, right?
Yes. So, which is not the strong and stable government.
No, that you're selling.
If you're a business party, if you're a party of business.
You bet. Well,
what's the one thing we always get told? A business is like certainty. If you were going to invest in New Zealand from offshore, would you want to invest in a country which might not make it past budget 2024? Because you might have your big plan chucked out the window by an incoming government. I mean, what he's proposing is the opposite of stability, and I wouldn't be surprised if a few business people had been on the line after that. Because,
which is probably why he got the frighteners on.
Well, quite possibly. Let's just have a listen, because it's interesting to hear him in his own words spell this out.
But when it comes to supply, actually, there's a lot of people voting X who want something a little bit different. They want to see it into the amount of government waste. They want to see less spending. And what we're saying is, well, back, you know, we give you confidence, but when it comes to supply, we want to negotiate each time to make sure that the people who voted for us who want less waste aren't being taken for granted.
Look, can I just explain this, what he's talking about here? Because this is begging back into the deep geek territory. But confidence and supply usually go together, like love and marriage, like a horse and carriage, as Frank Sinatra would sing, right?
Yep.
And I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. So you have confidence in the you pass a motion in Parliament that gives you the confidence of the House, and then you have the supply part, which allows you to actually have the confidence to spend the money because you know that the money is coming. He's saying he would, after the election, say, fill your boots, Mr. Luxon, head on up to Government House, talk to the Governor General, say, I can form a government. Because this is an interesting fact I didn't realise before I spoke to Andrew Giddis about this. What the Governor General needs to hear in these situations. Professor Andrew Giddis.
Yeah.
The Governor General needs to hear that person has the confidence of the House. It's not actually like I can form a government or my party is the most popular. It is the ability to go up and say, I can come back to you with a list of names that I can swear in as a cabinet to run the country. So I have the confidence of the House. So what David Seymour is saying is Christopher Luxon can go up to the Governor General, say I have that confidence, but I don't necessarily have the confidence to pass a budget next May because I've still got to negotiate this with ACT who are not yet happy and satisfied. And that's a really interesting situation because the Governor General has never faced that before. And Jerry Mataparai, when he was Governor General, said in a speech that a Governor General would preferably have certainty for a whole term when this happens after an election, but only preferably. It's not required. So the Governor General, if David Seymour put his foot down in this approach, would almost certainly have to accept that and say, yep, go, off you go, form a government and figure out the budget next year.
Look, I think it'll depend on what the ultimate result is on the election night. If they get to pretty much over 60 seats, they can form a coalition government between National and ACT, then I think he's going to take that all out the side and not worry about it. It's going to happen. The problem is if they don't get there and they need New Zealand First to get over the 60, that's where I think his head's gone, is going, well, hang on, I don't want to do any business with this dude. If he's going to be a part of any confidence and supply agreement, I might hold off. I don't think, my personal view is he put that out there for people to think about and not thought of the consequences, which is why he's withdrawn it or pulled back a bit from it. And the other interesting thing about it is when he talks like that, it's completely different to the way he talks to some media people, the likes of which, Lisa, you'll know in your interview yesterday on your show, where when he's calm and managed, he's talking in a certain way. When he's throwing in spitballing, he's got a completely different voice, and you heard it there. Completely different way of presenting himself. And yet yesterday he was, well, you know, very calm and measured in his approach. And that says to me that he's just come up with something on the fly, and it's probably bitten him a little bit, and he's probably not going to entertain it. But
because the politics would be terrible.
Oh, it'd be atrocious. But then if New Zealand First makes it, and they need New Zealand First to get over the 60 seats, that's why I think it's going to be really interesting.
He could throw his toys.
On the fly or calculated risk. That wasn't for the voters, in my mind. That was a warning. Warning to his potential friends in government, National. He has, and we've talked about this before, he keeps using this phrase about true sharing of power, right? And I think that was like, hey, well, you need us more than we potentially need you, even though we may be the smaller partner in this arrangement. And I think he's got his little campaign car, little Pinky, in reverse and screaming away from the scene.
But he doesn't want to be seen as the little partner,
no,
right?
Exactly.
He doesn't want to be the Greens again. He doesn't want to be the Greens stuck in there kind
not.
Of fading through six
but
years and not really getting the runs on the board that
he's got this conundrum because on the current polls you've got National around the 40% and he's and his party is only around the 10%. And as you say, he really desperately wants what he calls big change. But you could argue people have bought a cake, it's National, and David Seymour's just that little spreading of the icing on the top. So you could argue that. So they actually want National as the bulk. The bulk.
Well, that's what we're saying. They want a little bit of change, but not too much.
Yeah, but he used this phrase when I talked to him most recently. He said, I don't want to change from Chris to Christopher and wear a blue tie on Monday. So that is all about what he said more than a year ago. Yeah. He's harking back to that. He doesn't want same, but different tie.
But the interesting thing he mentions in the first 100 days are things that National's committed to anyway. So when you think about it, Three Waters, co-governance stuff, the Māori Health Authority, those things are going to happen in the 100 days. They're not bold because National supports them. National wants to do them as well. It's how much further he's going to go.
So what more do you think he wants? Do we have an idea about tax?
Yeah, that's right.
He's got massive tax aspirations to go down to only two tax brackets. What is it? 17.5% and 28%, I think, are the two tax brackets. And that's going to be pricey. He's already said with the opening of the books earlier this week that he's getting his calculator back out because they might have to back off some of their aspirations because of the moolah situation.
It was interesting what he said on that.
We're still working on our alternative budget. We've got a responsibility to show how the budget can balance. Right now we've got a bit of work to do on that, as does everybody who's taking this seriously. The money has run out. Grant Robertson's been on a spending binge for the last 6 years, borrowed $121 billion extra, and now there's nothing left and we're going to have to tighten up. Regardless of who is in charge, it's going to be very, very tough. And I don't think that Grant Robertson is being honest enough. I think he's just hoping, like Muldoon used to, that he can get away with it for another 3 years.
Very, very tough, right? He's signalling the cuts that he would like to bring in government.
Yes, and I put to him, you could be the finance minister in just over a month. And for the first time, he said, yeah, that's very hypothetical. But he didn't say, I don't want that job or I'm not talking about that. He talked about the fact that he would be working tightly and collegially, his words, with National, and that regardless of who the finance minister is, it's going to be a tough job balancing the books, and it's going to take hard and intense work between the two parties, he said. But he definitely has some things that he wants to achieve.
Yeah.
And it's going to take some squeezing to, meld the two wishes together.
Well, Act wants a minister of deregulation, right? Of going through
decluttering,
going through all the ministries and just finding line by line
it's
where
the Maria Kondo of politics. So that's a name, isn't it? The one who comes into your house and gets rid of your stuff.
Which is the way you do that, right? I mean, this is where it comes. So can Luxon hold to the centre? Does he want to hold to the centre? Does he use ACT to push into more cuts and more of that territory? Does he want Winston Peters on the side to be able to balance them off? Where do you see that shape going?
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things I'd say is that if he thinks he can withhold supply, that test would possibly come well before the 2024 budget, because any legislation on tax, for example, is considered supply, which inherently has confidence overtones. So if National were to come in and lower the tax thresholds, you need legislation to do that. That becomes a supply issue usually, and a confidence issue as well.
Yeah.
So I just don't think that he's thought that through constitutionally. So I think he's overplayed his hand there. Usually the major party's finance would hold. In other words, they would have the finance spokesperson, and it would be Nicola Willis, and you would have the bulk of their financial strategy. If ACT is around the 9 or 10 that the polls are showing now, you would think that with charter schools, a ministry for deregulation and a few other specific things, that they may be able to be sort of bought off with those. It also contains things a little more easily for ACT, so that they're not involved in more wide-ranging things that they can show to their voters. Here are some specific things that we're going to do. So that would be where the rationale and the logic of a MMP coalition would be. It just depends how much of this is bluffing and huffing and puffing from David Seymour and how much he's actually prepared to blow things up. I think, as a number of us have alluded to today, if Winston Peters is in the mix, then this is really, you know, the pins being pulled out of the grenade and everyone's jumping out of the table stuff. Because an ACT New Zealand First national arrangement is probably a fairly good recipe for us to do this all again and to go back to the country.
Do you think that would happen?
Well, I just can't see how that would work. And again, at that point, becomes a game of chicken, you know, but who's going to give way to who? Yeah.
And he held together.
He did. He did quite brilliantly.
And I've
talked about this before. If I were Luxon right now, I'd be swallowing a few dead rats or at least some kia ora and talking to the Māori Party and talking to the Greens about potential confidence and supply arrangements. I know that's a bit far out for some, but I think that sort of thing could pay dividends, because David Seymour and Winston Peters, as we know from their personalities, are very volatile and very belligerent politicians, and those personalities matter. Who's prepared to give way in a game of chicken? And you wouldn't necessarily want to be driving at 120k towards either of those individuals.
Yeah, a part of, look, I guess what we're saying is Winston's back.
We are. I think that's that, you know, I mean, I've raised my own odds from 50-50 to something like 80-20. I think it might have been Lisa who said before, if you see Peters at 5%, you know, a few weeks out, then he's probably going to be back. I think he probably will be back in Parliament on those numbers. The question in this election now, the question is, will ACT and National need New Zealand First?
He's back. Even if the numbers don't put him over the line, he's back in people's minds because they're considering the possibilities and prospects.
And that's the other thing that may work against Seymour's tactic here. If he's talking about blowing things up and being volatile and, oh, we want real neoliberal change. But some voters who do want a conservative, Luxon-led government are going to go, oh, well, Winston Peters, he was a pretty good handbrake on Jacinda Ardern.
It's the handbrake all over. It's the handbrake again.
I think Winston's looking at this and actually sort of chuckling away in that.
But that is why I think David Seymour brought his inside voice to the interview last night. That we did with him. He's changed his tone.
Agreed. We're talking about Winston, so before we go, he has got his voice back, and he's been using a bit of an outside voice, hasn't he, in terms of saying that Māori are not the Indigenous people. Yeah, Māori are not the Indigenous people.
I was waiting for Julian to do the
drum roll. No. We hadn't set up a TikTok or anything.
There was some TikTok going to be rolled out. Okay,
the other thing. The indigeneity question, and whether Māori are Indigenous to New Zealand or Cook Islands or, in fact, China.
Uncle, just stop it. It's ridiculous. He's confused point of origin with indigeneity. And he uses people like legends of Māoridom pantheons, Sir Peter Buck Te Rangihiroa and Ape Donangata, the father of Māori politics, father of Māoridom during the 1900s, as people who support his argument in this indigenous
and argument. Who he sees has his he sees Ngata's himself his as hero. A direct heir of these people, right?
Ngata's his hero. I mean, Ngata was a conservative, right? Yeah. And he uses them, as people who support his arguments. That is not what they did. It is not what their academic research focused on at all. In actual fact, what they focused on, particularly Sir Peter Buck, Māori anthropologist, was on the point of origin and our connections to the Pacific. What he probably talks about is people like Kupe and, you know, Hoturoa and Toi and all these people who navigated their way to Aotearoa from the islands. He's right, they're not Māori. They were Pacific Islanders. But it is their descendants who became and made us Māori, who then became the indigenous population of Aotearoa in New Zealand. He does this a lot, and you've got to congratulate him because it works. And that's the part that kills me about this, is people hear arguments that he makes about Māori not being indigenous to Aotearoa, and it is a stupid, facile, ridiculous argument. It has no academic support to it at all, but unfortunately people buy it.
It goes and it actually falls into that place of, the white Celts who were here before Māori, about the way Māori were conquered by Māori, therefore Pākehā can conquer Māori. It plays into that, and that's the bit that I find really disingenuous and quite awful about it, is that he knows the stuff, right? He's not ignorant to it, and he is prepared to actually appeal to the voters who somehow want to say, oh, if Māori aren't Indigenous, then somehow the treaty is gone, 180 years of legal precedent is gone, and we can all just be the same, and we don't have to deal with grievance and the hard conversations
well,
that, that we have to
Well, presumably those people won't need
and
to worry
nonsense.
About the United Nations Declaration
That's
on
right.
the Rights of Indigenous Peoples then.
That's right.
Because it will have no bearing under that logic.
Yeah, it's sad, to be honest with you. When and you hear, you know, I mean, Shane Jones... is an expert on this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
His Māori genealogy is unsurpassed, actually, for people in the North or others as well who are experts like Shane, but he's up there. Him and supporting this stuff actually is a disaster for students, for learners, for amateur historians, for amateur genealogists, and particularly for people from the North to hear some of their own saying this crap really hurts.
And speak to Hawaiki, because the way Winston puts it is that Māori are Indigenous to Hawaiki as if it's a place, as opposed to an idea, as in the place you were before. Hawaiki was the place, as you say, the point of origin, the place you were before. It's not like...
Yeah.
You know, New York or somewhere, right?
Yeah, an old man, Henare Kingi, who was a broadcaster guy, I might remember him from his parliamentary press gallery days. He was a broadcaster at the Māori radio station in Wellington, Te Pukotika. He described it as this: hawa means gap and iki means the field gap. And he says it's our point of origin, but it's also the place in which traditionally our spirits return to. And whether you believe that to be tapatapuatea, raiatea, rorotonga, as Winston says, and all that kind of stuff, that does not negate the point of indigeneity in Aotearoa New Zealand. It is simply a place of origin and a place where our spirits return to and rest. And that's what the translation of the name means. But, you know, this is finely tuned politics from Winston appealing to a voter base who would support him in this stuff. It's just unfortunate that in 2023 we're regurgitating actually things that are, again, the academic research of greats like Sir Peter Buck and Sir Apatanangata, and it's sad.
Yeah. It creates an interesting dilemma as well, I think, for coverage of a political campaign. I mean, how much airtime do you give to it? How much airtime do you give to that? How much airtime do you give to the insults that were levelled at Rāwhiti Waititi? And it was interesting that Rāwhiti himself, obviously when asked to respond, chose not to, to say that he was not giving oxygen to that.
The amazing thing to me is that Winston Peters can say all this about Indigenous people in New Zealand and then go overseas as a foreign minister. And every party seems to grant him that opportunity. And so he can weirdly oscillate between extremely polarising sort of dog whistle politics and then be the, you know, don the double-breasted pinstripe and be the statesman. And we seem to accept that in New Zealand. You know, it's us too. We have a really weird relationship with New Zealand First and Winston Peters. And collectively, we're all in that because how many times has he done this on any issue you'd like to name? It could be immigration, it could be any other host of number of issues. And yet here we are, nearly 40 years after he first came to Parliament, with the very real prospect that we've talked about today, that he could help decide who the government is.
Yeah, you mentioned Love and Marriage, a Frank Sinatra song, which of course was the title song for Married with Children with the Bundy family. That's pretty much what we're going to get if he makes it back in and they have to negotiate.
Peg and Al Bundy, yep.
All right, that is all we've got time for this week. Next week we'll be into debates, which we started to talk about this week, so we'll be looking forward to talking about those. Thanks for your time. It's been great to have your company. We'll talk to you again next week.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.